Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I am talking with Lobo, who is a co-host on the one of my favorite podcasts, Project Archivist. And he was on, the last time he was on, he talked briefly about having a near-death experience, and I said I would have him back to talk more about it. Well, finally, this is that episode. And it's totally not what I expected. I had not heard about what happened to him. Other than knowing that he had had such an experience, I didn't know anything about it. And this is a very interesting story. Also, for Patreons, we go on a little bit longer after this episode talking about some of his other experiences and thoughts on stuff and how it changed him. So, yeah, it's definitely suitable for a Halloweenish edition. It's a pretty scary story, I think. Also, a quick shout-out to Katie of the Night on YouTube, who listed us as one of her favorite paranormal podcasts. I really appreciate that. Thank you. And of course, thank you to everyone out there who supports us in any way, shape, or form. You're all awesome. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Lobo. All right, Lobo, welcome back to the show.
Greetings.
I believe last time I was actually on your show.
You were.
But it's been a while since you've been on here.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I was on.
You are the co-host of Project Archivist, one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh, thanks.
And you, how long have you been doing that?
Oh, we're going into our 7th year.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. We started in 2011, and it's going to be 2018. So.
And you do that with Rojan. And did you guys know each other beforehand?
We did. We were we were a little less than acquaintances on some different boards and some other podcasts. And Ro had, he was kind of set up actually on another show, and found out that at like the last minute that it was going to be me that was coming on. And he's like, oh crap, this guy's going to shoot me down, because we were talking about the Shroud of Turin. And it ended up, you know, amicably. I tried to be the best version of myself I could be. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I didn't really shoot him too much. I have my own views on it, as many other people do. And we got in contact after that and started kicking around the idea of having a podcast. And we were kicking around a name. And actually, the name of my solo shows is what the name of the podcast was, you know, thrown out there originally on my end as Spark. And, you know, Ro came back with Project Archivist, and we kicked back and started thinking about what archivists do, and it seemed to fit better. So, yeah, that's how that started. That was, I mean, it was out of a situation that could have gone horribly pear-shaped, it ended up turning into something good.
Yeah, like I said, yours is one of the ones I listen to regularly and generally enjoy.
Yeah, we do our best, I guess.
Well, you have really original shows.
Well, I mean, that was one of the things that Ro and I initially wanted to iron out. We'd been listening to other shows for years. You know, we listened to your show and to Eerie Radio and Banal of America, and we'd both listened to Coast to Coast for years. And it was just, you know, and Mysterious Universe before they went dark and then came back, and they, you know, they've been back with a vengeance since. But you know, we heard people on other shows, and they do interviews, and it seemed as though it was the same questions over and over again, like someone was given like a crib notes with every time someone would come on. And Ro and I both would listen to different people, you know, the same people on different shows ad nauseum. And we'd be like, there's gotta be another way to do this. You know, there's gotta be a way where we can talk to these people without, you know, asking all the same questions. I mean, of course, when you have somebody on, you got to ask like the canned one or two questions that are asked because that's what people want to hear.
Sure.
But Ro and I are from the mindset that I want to know what makes them tick. Mm. You know, I want to know, like when we had Stanton Friedman on. I mean, we've been listening to Stanton Friedman talk for, you know, decades. And I wanted to know what got him involved in his walkabout daily life, not what everybody was having him in to talk about. You know, we heard some really interesting stuff from him that I honestly never heard on any other shows. So, I mean, that was good. You know, we also have had, you know, authors on that, you know, have been on before. Like we had Linda Godfrey on before hardly anybody ever had her on. And we talked to her about her, you know, we wanted to know what she was about, what her research was. We didn't really want to hear just about the Dogmen. We wanted to hear what got her involved in what she was doing. You know, so we kind of want to, like, when someone gets the same score over and over and over again, you want to kind of pick that scab and find out what's underneath it. Which, yeah. I mean, for the both of us, our entire lives, we've been doing that. So,
Well, it definitely
that was the
works.
Impetus for the show.
Thanks. The Stanton Friedman one, I mean, it's been ages since I've listened to Stanton Friedman, and he was on your show, and I'm like, I don't know. But it's Project Archivist. You know what? I'm going to listen to it. And I'm like, yep, I don't know any of this stuff. This is really interesting. You could tell you kind of took him off of his, a little bit off his comfort level.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we tell people when we have him on, you know, we usually have a conversation with him before we start recording. And there's email that goes back and forth and text messages and stuff that usually goes back and forth with guests. They're going to be coming on. And, you know, we tell them right out of the gate, we're not going to buttonhole you, or, you know, we're not going to throw you curveballs, but we're not going to give you softballs either. You know, we're going to ask you this, this, and this. And, you know, there may be, we want you to talk about what's going on with you, you know? So, I mean, when we first started Project Archivist, I wanted Stanton to come on. I wanted him to come on, and I didn't want to hear about the UFO side of his life. And for years, Ro bucked me. He's like, nah, man, we can't have him on. He's already talked about everybody. And finally, Ro's like, all right, whatever. Let's just do this. It's something you wanted to do, so let's just do it. And it turned out to be, I mean, I can't say that I have a favorite show, but it's up there. I mean, my favorite shows are probably ones that no one expects. You know, like people that are, like, not really heard of, or I love having Dr. Coke John on. I mean, I love talking to Tyler. I mean, he's a brain, a huge brain. So listening to him, you know, I get text messages from him. I get emails from him. I'm not really a presence on Twitter as much as I used to be, but he tags me and stuff. And I just love talking to the guy. So, I mean, that's what we aim for. We wanted to make a show that we'd want to listen to. And I have to admit, I'm like one of our biggest fanboys. I listen to our own show. I've literally heard everything that was going to be said, but I at some point, I don't know if any other podcasters do this, but Ro gets so mad at me because we'll have somebody on and I'm quiet. I'm so busy listening to what the person's saying that I get lost in, oh crap, I'm supposed to ask questions too.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
You know? So when I listen to the show, like there'll be points where I'm listening to what the guy's saying, and then I'll go off on my own tangent in my little skull, and then I'll come back around and I'm still listening on a different level. But when I listen to it, you know, at work through my headphones, I'm like, wow, yeah, that's really cool. Man, that guy knows what he's talking about. And then I'm like, wait a minute, I asked him that question. So it's funny. It's funny that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had that experience before where I'm listening back to saying, going, huh, I don't remember asking that. That was a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Huh. All right. Excellent. I actually try to avoid listening to this show back because I always feel self-conscious about it for some reason.
Well, I have no shame.
I do listen back to my music show, but that's also because, when we do the music show, we don't usually hear what we're playing so much. I kind of sample through stuff before I play it, like new stuff, and then I play it. But there's so much going on in the studio that I don't actually hear it. So then I listen back to it. It's like a nice 6-hour mixtape that I made myself.
There you go.
And then I get to actually hear the songs and be like, okay, yeah, that was good. That was not, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, see, we're our own worst critics. That's been proven time and time again. But I mean, me, I tell Ro all the time, and I have trouble with other human beings at the point where sometimes I have to look around for social cues because I honestly don't know how I'm supposed to be reacting to things. So when it comes to, like, I tell the kids all the time, I have three daughters, and they're getting less and less embarrassed. I tell them, what are you getting embarrassed for? It's a useless emotion. It serves no purpose. It does no good to you. Just do what you want to do and hope for the best.
Yeah.
You know? True. So, I mean, my wife tells me all the time, I'm a shameless pig. I mean, I just don't, I don't get it. I mean, I know how to act around other people for the most part, because I've been doing it for so long as a chameleon, but there's just some times where I'm caught off guard and I'll be like, ah, I'm supposed to be looking at I laughed and I wasn't supposed to. That's probably bad. But then I'm like, nah, whatever. They know who I am by now.
Fair enough. And the last time we had you on, we had mentioned briefly that you had had a near-death experience. We talked about some of your weird experiences, but we mentioned this near-death experience, and you kind of shrugged it off a little bit.
I think about it every day. There isn't a point during the day that I don't think about some aspect of it. And that's, we're going on February, it'll be 5 years.
Okay. And I promised people I was going to bring you back on to talk about this. So that's what this is. I mean, now that we got all that shop talk done. what happened?
Well, how far back do you want to know? Do you want to know that? I mean, I had gotten wounded at work.
Okay.
I work on presses, but they're old presses. They're you kick them with your leg. Mm. And I had a press that we've had since, wow, Christ was a cowboy. We've had it forever. And I had gone to move something inside the press, and I wasn't paying attention. I was talking to one of my constituents at work, and I kicked it, and it crushed my finger.
Oh.
And when it crushed my finger, unbeknownst to me, it had forced strep A that was either on the machine or on the surface of my skin into my bloodstream.
Man.
And I didn't know. I honestly didn't know. I cleaned it out. I covered it. For all intents and purposes, it healed outwardly. It healed. It had a layer of skin over it, and it didn't look as though it was infected in any way.
Right.
But I started feeling ill. And I just thought it was the time of the year where, you know, flu goes around and there's just any number of sicknesses that go around. And I have children, and children are a petri dish.
Right.
So I figured that they had given me something. Well, I had it for a month, and I'm like thinking to myself, you know, the flu doesn't usually last this long. I don't know of anything systemically that should last this long.
Right.
But I ignored it. You know, I pushed it off. I ignored it. And about 2 weeks before I ended up in hospital, I had been vomiting and I just couldn't keep any food down. And, I was very lethargic, and I just, again, chalked it up to, I must have a bug of some form. Mm-hmm. Well, during this period of time, my body was slowly shutting down. My organs were starting to shut down. Everything was slowly shutting down. And I developed a rash all over my body, which later on I found out was scarlet fever, because the strep virus is conducive to scarlet fever. Wow. So my immune system had dropped so low at that point that I was shot. I couldn't keep anything in. I was literally evacuating from both ends, and I couldn't get off the couch. I had passed out on the floor in the bathroom at home. I passed out in my car when I parked in my driveway. And the real warning sign that I needed to do something, and at that point my wife called my father-in-law to bring me to the hospital, was I finally made it down to my bed after being on the couch for days. But I was still going to work every day. I'd go to work at night when everybody, you know, came home from work. I'd lumber into work, pale as a piss of bed, and just I'd pass out at work, and I made it down to my bed, and my wife, for whatever reason, had a late start that day. So she was home putting the kids on the bus, and I was down in the bedroom, and I looked at my phone, and I literally didn't know what it was.
Huh.
I was like, okay, what is this thing? What is this for? This is a magnificent creation. What is it for? And I'm like, oh, I'm like, then, it, you know, I'd waver back into reality, and I'd be like, okay, it's babe, I need to do something. So she had her father come and pick me up. He brought me to the hospital. And the only words that I could get out is like my finger, ouch. And the woman's like, okay, you need to go in the back. So they brought me in the back. And at that point, the nurse went to go give me an IV. And I mean, it drained the bag immediately. And they had to hit me with a second IV at the same time. And she goes, you're literally the worst case of dehydration I've ever seen without being a fatality. And I'm like, oh, well, it's hooray for me.
Yeah, I mean, right.
So that night, I was put on, I was in the emergency room, and they got me a bed, and they brought me up to my room. And that's when I was gone. I was gone. And, that's when everything, from what I'm told, it was an NDE. To this day, I scratch my head. It was realistic. It was, for it to have like, dreams go away, you know, like dreams yeah. disappear and you forget them, but this is still crisp and clear after almost 5 years. And, you know, I don't want to say that I had like some kind of epiphany from it. Like I do look at things differently now than I did before a little bit. Cause I kind of went into like, I've always been like, I've been a realist like most of my life, mm-hmm. and it caused flack in early life, and it caused even more flack later in life. But, you know, I remember being put into, the hospital bed, in my room, and they were starting me on a round of, I want to keep saying it's antioxidants, but it's not. It's, like essential salt, potassium, and okay. and I don't know. It'll come back to me in the middle of talking, and I'll spout it out like I, you know, have Tourette's or something. But they started giving me this round of IVs that had, you know, potassium in them and sodium and different things, electrolytes. They started giving me electrolytes. So I mean, like heavy courses of electrolytes. And they hadn't given me any sedatives or anything like that. And I drifted off. And I actually thought I was falling asleep. And then that's when, like, the whole experience started. And it was very, very dark. And, like it was black to the point where you're in upstate New York. When you go out in the woods and it's dark, there's no lights, it's mm-hmm. freaking dark. Like you cannot, if the moon is not out, you cannot see your hand in front of your face.
Right.
And it was that dark. And even in dreams, I've never had it to the, usually everything's in like a twilight in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Even in some of my darkest moments on the dreamscape or even on the astral plane, it's not completely dark. There's always a hint of some form of, like, even if it's like a effluence of light, there's something, there's a right. shimmer.
Yeah.
This was black. Black is coal. And, slowly things around me started, like it started lightening up, but only like just the slightness of perception. And I realized that I was underwater because the atmosphere around me was too thick to be the air.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I was slowly starting to move, and I wasn't in a prone position. I was upright, but I was trying to move through this atmosphere, and it didn't feel right. I mean, it literally felt like you were, you know, when you're a kid, you try to get to the bottom of a pool, like the deep end, and you try to sit on the bottom,
yeah.
and then you slowly try to start moving without rising to the surface. It was just like that.
Hmm.
And as I'm locomoting, because it didn't really feel like walking really, but it was a form of locomotion forward. I could start hearing something like in the distance, and it sounded like a voice, but it wasn't really a voice at that point yet. It was like when you're outside of a building, when there's like really loud bass going on,
mm-hmm.
you can't, or no, better, a better example is when you're around heavy machinery, you can feel the noise in you without actually hearing it perceptibly.
Right. Right.
And that's what I could hear it through my bones. It wasn't actually coming through my auditory canals. It was through my bones that I heard it. And it wasn't really a voice at that point, but I could tell it was trying to make syllables. So I'm moving forward very, very slowly. It was like walking through tar. And then I start hearing it, and I could tell the direction it was coming from. So I can't say that I was heading in that direction, but I could tell where it was coming from at that point. It slowly got more and more like a voice. And we've spoken before, and I told you about the day before I got clean, I tried to kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a voice tell me, get up, get yourself clean, and go and get help. And it was the same voice. Like, it was the same exact voice. And this time, this voice wasn't telling me that it was going to help. It was telling me, no one, this is the bottom. No one lives, no one leaves here.
Hmm.
I'm like, okay. Like, this is the void. No one leaves here. So I was like, all right, well, I got to go. I got things to do. So I slowly started moving forward faster and faster. But it was still at a snail's pace.
Right.
And I could hear it. And it was getting louder and it was getting louder, and I could see where the voice was coming from. And it was a darkened cave, and you could just barely make out eyes that were in the cave. And it kept saying that, no one leaves here. No one leaves here. And I was like, all right, I don't really want to listen to you because no. And at one point I was in the water, and I could see up above me, and it was like leagues above me, and it was the bottom of a ship. And at that point, I didn't know what kind of ship it was. It was just a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it was literally the only thing I could see above me, but I could tell that it was moving and it wasn't stationary. And then all of a sudden I'm ripped up and I'm up above this ship, but it's still like underwater. Like, it's water within water. And it's like a demon galleon that I'm looking down on. It's got busted wood, and there's fire damage, and the sails are destroyed. And it's just, it looks like it's battle hardened. It just looks like at any moment, Davy Jones is going to be like at the helm of this thing. And then I was back at the bottom of the ocean, but I can still see that ship. And there was a picture about 6 months after this experience that popped up on the internet, and I'm like, oh my God, that's the ship I saw. And I had never seen the ship before, ever, in my whole life. And the name on the bottom of the ship is the Demon Galleon. I'm like, oh, okay. Now, mind you, this is months and months after the experience. So I'm like, right. Okay. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, maybe I saw it at some point in my life. But apparently this picture was made, you know, the early part of 2014, like right around the same time I was in the hospital. So I couldn't have seen it anywhere else.
Wow.
So I'm like, all right. So that was a little weird. So I keep moving and I'm moving. Now I'm back on the bottom, but I can see that it's getting lighter. And the voice is further away, but at the same time, it's almost the same timbre. It's still, no one leaves here. This is the bottom. This is the void. No one leaves here. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I left the abyss behind me, so I must be moving towards life. It's the only thing that could come into my head. So I'm walking and I'm walking and I'm walking. And I could see that I'm in the shallows because everything's getting brighter. But it's got this really weird color to it. I'm like, all right, whatever. Now, mind you, at this point, it's gone from black into a deep blue, and it's stayed pretty much like this deep blue the whole time. until I start getting towards the shallows. And I'm like, all right. And then there's just this weird wavering that I can see. I can see that the surface of the water is within my reach and I'm going to be out of this and everything's going to be over and I'm going to wake up from this dream and it's going to be over. Nope. I walk out of the water and then all of a sudden everything flashes over and everything is completely engulfed in flames. Hmm. And I'm like, okay, so much for my idea of getting out of here anytime soon. And I can consciously hear myself saying this.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep walking and as I'm walking, I'm noticing that like everything's on fire, but it's not burning. Like the grass is on fire, but it's not burning. And like the trees are on fire and the sky is on fire and the birds, or I'm assuming they were birds, are on fire. And I'm like, oh, God, this is horrible. But I can't feel the heat from the flames, which I would have expected to feel the heat. But then I'm like, I didn't feel the cold of the depths either. So, okay, if this is my outer body or my inner body, then I'm not going to be feeling any pain. So I'm walking and I'm trying to get by and I'm trying to figure out where on earth I'm supposed to be going, which I know it's not earth. And at this point, I'm still believing that I'm dreaming.
Hmm.
So I'm like, I'm going to wake up from this at any point, and this is going to be all over with, and I'm going to be in my hospital room, and, you know, but it just, it goes on for eternity, and I'm just walking, and I'm thinking to myself, this is like Dante's Inferno. It's never going to end. And I look over, and on the hillside where all the grass is burning and the buildings are burning, there are these things that are eating the burning grass. And I'm like, oh, all right, well, I guess there's sheep where I live. And I hear, this is the Midlands. No one leaves the Midlands. I'm like, okay. And it's the same voice. And I'm like, all right, well, I still have to leave, so I'm just going to keep walking. And as I'm passing these things, I'm looking at these creatures, which I had assumed were sheep. But they were not sheep. They were more like hogs, only not hogs. They were human beings that had devolved into these flabby fungus looking creatures, and they were engulfed in flame and they were making the most horrendous sounds, but it was like not like painful sounds, like not like a dying pig sounds, like they were just these awful sounds, but they were, I mean, their feet weren't feet. They weren't like a pig's trotter. Like if you look at a pig's foot, it looks like a pig's foot.
Right.
These look like people's hands that have devolved into pig's feet. Like you could still see like crude visage of human hands that had just turned into these trotters. And they were on all fours. They had lost the ability to stand upright. And they were just, I'm like, I got to get out of here. I kept thinking to myself, I mean, is this how far we've devolved? And I'm walking and it still says, this is the Midlands. No one leaves here. This is the Midlands. No one leaves here. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. Cause I'm listening to this voice and it's a voice that tried to help me at one point. And now I'm like, dude, you really want me to stay here? I got a wife and kids to worry about. I can't stay here. So I continue to move and I'm going up an incline and everything is still burning. I mean, it's stuff that there's a river and it's on fire. I'm like, this is the worst. No one is ever going to pick a place like this for vacation. So I can't imagine why I'm even thinking of this. And mind you, all of the scenery, all of the flora and the fauna around me, they don't look like anything I've ever seen before. I mean, not even in a fever dream have I ever seen anything like this before. I mean, everything is like not shaped right. It's all like, it's non-Euclidean. Nothing's right. Nothing's right. Everything's just off, just enough. So I continue up forward and I can see that there's this ridge that I can make it to. And I'm thinking to myself, maybe if I can get to the top of this ridge, I can see where I need to go to get out of here. Because at this point, I'm realizing this isn't a dream anymore. I'm not dreaming. This is where I am. I need to find a way out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been on the plane, the astral plane, and it was nothing like that. I was not in my, it was me, but not me at the same time. I mean, I know what it feels like. And, you know, I'm sure there's people listening right now that are like, oh, this guy's full of garbage. He doesn't know what he's talking about. I know what it feels like to be out on the plane. This was not that. It was, there was no disconnect from when you go out on the plane, there's a disconnect. You know, you're leaving your body. That wasn't there. That was, I'm dragging this carcass with me because it's part of me. So I get to the top of this ridge and I'm like, all right. And I just keep walking. And as I'm walking, I'm slowly realizing that I'm no longer on the ground walking. I'm off in the expanse walking. And then everything at that point, when I realize I'm in the expanse, flashes over white and everything is just white. And I'm like, okay, it's like nothing. There's nothing there. Like it was like a white piece of paper. But I can tell that there's like the outlines of like structure, but it's not. It's like it's literally like someone ran out of toner. And it's just everything's just white. So at this point, the voice is very loud, and it's like, this is the Highlands, and no one leaves here. This is the end. No one leaves the Highlands. And I'm like, okay. So I'm just slowly I'm gathering speed and momentum. For the first time, I'm gathering speed. And I'm like, all right, well, there's got to be some, this has to reach to some point because I need to get out of here. So I'm slowly, not slowly, but you know what I mean. It's gradually picking up speed, picking up speed, picking up speed. And I'm no longer walking. I'm no longer moving under my own power. I'm moving faster than I've ever felt like I've moved before, even in dream. You know, you get those points in dream, like even when you're falling, you reach like critical mass and you know you can't go any faster.
Right.
That, I didn't have that feeling. I was like, oh crap, this is like I've never felt before. This may be it. I'm dead. I'm dead. At this point, I realize I'm dead. This is what it is. I'm dead. So I'm coming to what feels like I'm going to be, you know, into the light as everybody talks about. But let me tell you something right now. There was no baby Jesus. There was no light. There was no ancestors. There was none of that. I didn't see angels. I didn't see any of that. If what I saw was what the afterlife is like, or what the near-death experiences, and I've talked to people that have had them, they sound eerily familiar to what I was going through. It's not heaven, whatever that was. So I get to the point, and I'm still accelerating, and I hit the ceiling, and it shatters. But I didn't see the ceiling coming. And as I hit it, I expect there to be glass and the sound of breaking glass. But as I hit it, it ruptures and it's gears and clockwork. And
how very steampunk.
It's like for real. And I hit it. And as I'm hitting it and as I'm moving faster, I can see the, you know, when you look forward, you can just barely make out the tip of your nose. Mm-hmm. Just barely, if you're concentrating. I can start to see my nose turning into a muzzle. And it's getting longer, and I know what it is because I can see the fur on it. And at that point, everything breaks, and I can hear it, and I can see it, and I hear a howl, and then I'm back in my hospital room. Huh. And I'm looking around going, wow, man, that was a great dream. But I can still hear all the noises in my head.
Right.
And none of them match what's going on in the hospital room. Nothing. The beeping I'm hearing from the machinery doesn't sound like the gears. The talking that I'm hearing sounds like no one in the room or outside in the hallway. There's no television set on in my room. The only thing I could hear in my room is the machine that's pumping liquid into me. I'm like, and it's still in my head. As I'm coming out of this, and I'm like, and then it was gone. You know, everything, it was as fast as it was there, it was gone. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I'm laying in my bed and I'm like, what just happened? And I struggled with that for a long time. Like, I still struggle with it because I don't know part of me doesn't know if it was like something going on in my brain or if it was actually a near-death experience.
Right.
Because it doesn't, I mean, it sounds remarkably like a lot of other people I've spoken to and reached out to, but in the same tokens, it has aspects of it that match nobody else's. And I'm like, all right, well, if it's my own NDE, then of course it's going to have things that don't match with other people's because they're going to have things that don't match with other people's. But when I got out of the hospital, I couldn't close my eyes without reliving the entire thing over and over and over again for months afterwards. Like every time I'd close my eyes, I was back. And it would bring me back to like different places at different times. Like one day I'd be in the Highlands when I closed my eyes, and another day I'd be in the Midlands when I closed my eyes. And it was, you know, and there's been points in the last 5 years where I'll be standing somewhere and it's almost like there's a glitch and all around me will be engulfed in flames and then it's gone. And all around me will be dark blue, like I'm underwater, and then it's gone. And it's like a split second where I like have to stop and go, am I still here?
Right.
You know, and there's been times that I'm like, am I still in the hospital? Is all of this just me in the hospital still? Is any of this happening? You know, am I laying somewhere in a bed? Am I in a bed right now talking to you in my head?
Right.
It's the most bizarre experience on that level that I've ever had. I mean, I've had a lot of strange experiences in my life that I can't readily explain. This one is in a different category all to itself.
There seems to be a lot of symbolism in there.
Yeah, I mean, I've had shamanic experiences in my life before of being ripped apart and put back together again. This one takes the cake.
But you weren't really. But it doesn't seem like you were ripped apart. You were just kind of like forced to fight up from the depths of something.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't have that when I was going through the DTs when I first got clean. I mean, I was strung out for a while when I first got clean, and I didn't have anything like that. I mean, I had an air conditioner talk to me and a box of yodels that was on top of a thing talk to me. And I knew that wasn't real. This felt as real as me right now. Like, it felt like I was actually there. And it bothered me because I went in without a... I have a really bad, I don't really want to say prejudice, but I'm not real fond of religion.
I was going to ask you, were you raised anything?
I was raised
particular?
A Jehovah's Witness. I was raised a Jehovah's Witness. Yeah, I got kicked out when I was 14 from the religion and I lost everybody.
What did you do?
I was accused of premarital sex, and at that point I didn't have it, and I was going to be damned if I didn't go after it.
Nice.
You know, I already paid the piper, so I was going to listen to the tune.
Huh.
It was bizarre. It was bizarre.
So how did that color your view of religion?
I had listened to people before talk about how they had near-death experiences, and they talked about, like, baby Jesus and how they saw the light and, you know, there was a loving God. And I'm like, dude, really? Because that's not what I had. And then they're like, oh, well, it's because you have a tainted past and, you know, we all know where you're going. I'm like, I pretty much know where I'm going too, and it's not where you believe I'm going. So you can have that, you know, with your judgment. So, I mean.
I think with that type of an experience, it's molded to who we are. I don't think, you know, like when people see Jesus, they also see every other religious figure. So either all religions are true, or these experiences are very much molded to us.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. It makes sense.
It was actually one of the things that I found really interesting about the Seth material early on, because that's what Seth says. He says, you know, when people die, they almost have to go through a play of giving them what they expect before they can, you know, kind of like accommodate them to the new reality they're in.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I guess that makes sense on a certain level. It's just the way that it felt. I mean, like I have had some experiences that were similar in nature, Mm-hmm. Like certain aspects of them were similar in nature, but to have it at this level was like, it was I was standing in the yard with a hockey stick and everybody was playing football. I mean, I literally was out of my depth on that one.
Did you actually die? Do you know?
I don't know. I have no idea to this day. I have no idea. Hmm. They didn't, there was nothing on my chart about coding. I have no idea. That's the part that bothers me the most about calling it a near-death experience, because I don't know whether or not I died.
Well, research into near-death experiences has shown that some people have near-death experiences who don't die, and other people die and don't have near-death experiences. So it's not strictly a situation where you have to be clinically dead to have the experience.
Right. I told my wife about it, and I told her about it after I had spoken to Ro about it.
Mm.
So there was a little, I don't want to say there was resentment there, but there kind of was.
Right.
On some
right.
level that I told somebody, but I had to tell somebody what was going on, and I didn't, the wife was really fragile at this point, like extremely fragile. She literally thought she was going to lose me. She was terrified.
Right. Right.
You know, my kids were terrified. I mean, there are points when, like, I'm not ashamed to say that I was frightened, because I don't get scared by much.
Mm-hmm.
I was terrified. I literally thought that this was it. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I made it through all that before to get to this. Like, I mean, I literally cheated death numerous times in active addiction and before active addiction and since active addiction. I mean, you know, you don't really learn right away when we get right. clean, but I mean, I'm like, this is what's going to take me out. It was bizarre. It was bizarre, to say the least. So, I mean, there was a little bit of reservation there that I didn't want to talk about it to anybody in the beginning. Right. I didn't want to tell anybody what was going on. I already have people look at me crazy now because of stuff I talk about and things I've seen or I believe I've seen. So there was that little sense of apprehension in the beginning where then I'm like, you know what? The worst anybody can do is kill me, and I'm not really afraid of that anymore.
Did it remove your fear of death?
I didn't really have a fear of death to begin with.
Okay.
Per se. I've never really been, when I was little, I was afraid of dying,
mm-hmm.
but I've been, I mean like little, but yeah. I've been surrounded by murder and suicide for like my whole life. So death is like, whatever, there's no way to stop it. It's going to happen no matter what.
Well, sure. Sure.
So there's never really been that. Like I said, when I was little, I think I lost my fear of dying when I was like 3 or 4, because I've been a macabre person my whole life.
Mm.
So, I mean, there's a certain, like, I don't want to say fear of it, but like, I have kids now, you know, there's a little more urgency in things. I have three daughters. Right. So, I mean, there's a little, but I'm still not afraid to die. I'm afraid of what's going to happen to them if I go, but I'm not afraid to die. If that makes sense.
That's fair. No, that totally makes sense. And that's fair. You're more concerned about them than yourself.
Yeah, which is strange because, I mean, first of all, I want to know what, you know, universal entity decided that I was supposed to be in charge of 3 children, because that seems like a bad idea.
I think you might have had some part in that decision.
Yeah, well, you know, sort of. But, I mean, still, you know, it's a crapshoot either way. I know a bunch of people that kind of tried to make the decision that still don't have kids. So,
right. But it's easier, I think, in some ways to not have kids sometimes.
I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that wholeheartedly.
Because, I mean, there's things you can do to generally prevent such things from happening.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas if you want to have kids and the something's not right, you're just not going to have kids.
Right. Yeah, if your stuff's busted, then, you know, there's no real way around that. Well, nowadays there is, but
yeah,
you know what I mean.
There's more and more, yeah. Honestly, what bugs me is when I see people who don't want to have kids because their parents pressured them into it.
Yeah, dude, that is infuriating. I mean, look, let's be honest. You got to get a permit for a gun. You got to have a driver's license to drive an automobile. You got to get a marriage license to get married, but you can just pop kids out.
Well, sure.
Like, I mean, literally, you know what? I'm sure there's people looking at me right now going, how does he have kids? So, I mean,
So how did this experience change you?
Well, see, it's weird because I went into the experience not knowing it was going to be an experience.
Right, right.
Which, you know, sometimes that's the best teacher, is when you don't know you're being given a lesson.
Mm-hmm.
But what did I get out of it? I got a lot out of it, but it's hard to put into words. Like, the sun is a little bit brighter.
Okay. Made you appreciate things more?
Maybe a little bit more, but it's on a deeper level. It's not so much, it's hard to explain. Like stuff that I never really noticed before.
Mm.
I notice more now. Like, it's hard to explain. There's a little more of something.
Okay.
But it's not just in one area of my life. It's like a lot of little mores.
Gotcha.
Like, I know my wife loves me. But I never realized how much until that point. And my kids have to love me or else. You know, but like little things that used to bother me don't anymore.
Mm.
Like, I'm okay sitting in a red light.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm okay. Like, if I'm in line and there's somebody behind me that's having trouble being patient, I'm okay stepping aside and saying, by all means.
Right.
And not, you know, not be a jerk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, whereas before, I'm like, okay, you know, if it's really that important, by all means. You know, but I find myself being a little more patient with other humans.
Hmm.
Whereas before, I had a general disdain for humans as a whole, which I can't really say is completely gone, but I have a little more patience with them now.
Right.
Which, I mean, maybe that's because of the experience. Maybe that's just me getting older.
Sure.
You know, but I'd like to think that, you know, it happened when I was, 36? No, wait a minute.
2014 was 3 years ago.
Then it happened in 2013.
Okay.
I don't remember how old I was. That's disturbing because usually I know.
I don't know how old I am now, so I don't, you know.
No, it was 2012.
Was it 2012?
No, it was 2013. It was 2013 is when it happened because it's going to be 2018 and that'd be 5 years.
Mm, okay.
So yeah, I'm 42. Yeah, I was 30. I was 37. So it was, has that much really changed? No, because no. I'm going to be that guy that stands on his front steps and get off my lawn. I'm not, there's a different perception of things is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Which is peculiar because there's been periods in my life where I've gotten to that point through dramatic means, but this takes the cake. It's almost like it was supposed to be a learning experience.
Yeah.
And I wasn't being open to it, so it was forced to be by whatever means necessary.
I suspect most near-death experiences are learning experiences.
I'd like to hope.
Well, what I mean is I don't think the experience is random, and I think the reason some people don't have them is because they're not meant to have them. Or they just don't remember them afterwards because it wasn't something that profoundly affected them because it wasn't something that needed to profoundly affect them.
Hmm. That's, you know? Yeah. I mean, it would have been much nicer if I had been just given a note. I know how to read.
But then you wouldn't have such an interesting story about it.
No, it's true. I probably wouldn't have the same amount of appreciation for it either.
Yeah.
You know, anything worth having is worth earning.
That is true. And it did you have any weird experiences after it?
Oh, my entire life is a weird experience.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I mean, you know, yeah, there was a bunch of synchronicity that happened shortly after it. You know, people showed up that I hadn't seen in years that, you know, wouldn't normally be brought out of the woodwork and had no idea what was going on. I was given my Native American name shortly after that from a woman that is a Native American. She went through a ritual with me. So it was interesting. I still have the totem that I was given. I still carry the name that I was given.
Nice.
So, I mean, yeah. It's weird because I had the year before, 2 years before, Grandpa had died. The wife's grandfather had died. And we were all given these little wooden turtles, which I still wear. Mm-hmm. And I had taken it off when I was in the hospital. Of course, I had to take it off when I was in the hospital. But whenever I wasn't in an MRI or a CAT scan, that was on. And it always felt warm against me. No matter how cold the room was, it always felt warm against me. And it's wood. It should be neutral. It shouldn't feel like anything.
Right. That's interesting.
So, yeah.
Huh.
Yes.
Would you, if given the choice, not have had the experience?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. I would not trade that for anything.
So even though it was seemingly very unpleasant.
Oh, I would have it. I would have it again right now. If I was going to learn something from it, I would have it again right now.
Hmm. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay.
I've realized that through my life, you know, you hear about, you know, history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. You hear about it all the time. And it's not so much that it repeats itself, but it does rhyme. And every experience that I've had in my life, if I choose to ignore it, it doesn't happen again, but it's real close to happening again.
Right. It's almost like you didn't learn the first time. Here it is again.
Yep. But it's packaged a little differently.
Yes.
Yeah. Like it's more palatable. Yeah, that time in the hospital was bizarre. I mean, it's off track. It doesn't have anything to do with the near-death experience, maybe. But before going into the hospital, I couldn't stand McDonald's food at all. I think it was rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
I could not taste anything when I was in the hospital. Everything was garbage. Everything tasted like sawdust. Nothing had flavor. The first food that had flavor was McDonald's, and I cannot drive by a McDonald's without my mouth watering. I want to eat it every single day. And I don't, of course, but I can't smell a French fry. I can't. It's a complete and total Pavlovian response every single time.
That's kind of crazy.
It's weird. And my wife's like, you hated McDonald's before. I'm like, I know. I got nothing. I don't know what to tell you.
Clearly, that was the whole point of your experience.
Yeah, dude, the clowns got me.
Your experience was sponsored by McDonald's.
How great would that be?
And for people, it was a while ago that you talked about your other experience. You mentioned briefly hearing the voice when you OD'd.
Oh, I didn't OD.
Oh, you didn't OD.
No.
You were just trying to kill yourself.
Okay, it was June 21st.
Yeah, I was going to say, why don't you tell people the story for the people who didn't hear you talk about it previously, which was probably over a year ago now.
It was June 21st, 1995. I had been on a bender, and you got to realize that Lobo in active addiction is not a good creature to be around. I was extremely manipulative. I could literally get anybody to do anything I wanted. There was a certain amount of, presence that was not my own that I could literally get. I got, even after getting clean, I still held on to that. There are times when I find myself falling back into it and I have to be real careful about it. because I can still get people to do things they don't want to do. And I try on a conscious level to not do that if someone is not agreeing with me.
Right.
But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So June 21st, 1995, I woke up that morning after being on a bender the night before. I was sober when I woke up. I decided at the point when I woke up that I was going to leave. It was time for me to check out of this great blue marble in the sky or in the universe or space or whatever. And it was time for me to go. I'd heard enough people and it was time for me to go. The night before, apparently I was yammering on about it, but I don't recall talking about it. Mm-hmm. So my friends went into my automobile, which was the Buick, and took all of my weapons out of the car. All of them. There was nothing left in there.
I'm assuming this is before you were married.
Oh, yeah. Way before I was married. I got clean when I was 19.
Okay.
So I had almost a year clean when I met my wife. So when we started dating, I was like a week shy of a year clean.
Okay.
So it was June 15th, 1996. I got my clean date is June 22nd, 1995. So I was like a week shy of being a year clean before I started dating her. Okay. So on that day, I walked around the house that I was living in. It wasn't my parents' house. I was living with my fiance at the time. I lived with her and her parents. And I couldn't find paper anywhere. So, you know, in true Lobo fashion, I found a great big piece of white oak tag and a black marker. And I wrote my suicide note on a giant, like, poster-sized thing because I couldn't find paper anywhere. There was nothing in the house. So I got in my car and I drove to the other side of town where I grew up. And there's a road on that side of town called Tyler Mill Road. And it's an area of high strangeness. It always has been. It probably always will be. They just found a couple more dead people on it last year around this time. So there's always, it's a place where people go to kill themselves. It's a place of power. It's a place of high strangeness. When I was younger, we used to drive through it and, you know, the radio would go out, the car would die, lights would go out. It's an interesting, strange place. Hmm. And at the time, the way I got to it was there's another road called Tamarack Swamp. And I drove through Tamarack Swamp and it connects to Tyler Mill. And I drove out far enough where if somebody, when they realized I was gone, because I didn't say where I was going in the note, because mm-hmm. I'm not that stupid. I didn't want anybody to find me. So even if I was marked as missing, it would take them at least 3 days to find me, at least. And by that point, I'd be far beyond and there'd be no hope.
Right.
So I drove out there and the place where I drove is in the middle of, it's like the waypoint in between the entrance and the exit of Tyler Mill. And there were no houses around. It hadn't been developed at that point. It's since had some development done to it, but still, it's still an undeveloped area. And it was shortly after I got clean, actually, that the mayor of the town, the one thing that he's done that I don't see as shady was he had a shell company buy up a bunch of property all around the reservoir on that side and made it so no one can ever build on it. Mm. So it's all wetlands. It's watershed. No one can ever build on it. There'll be no more development in that area. So, and it's in our charter. So it's not like someone can just go and, hey, you have to actually change the charter for it to happen. So, I drove out there and I get out of my car and I immediately go around to the back and there's no knives in the back. Like, all right. So I check under my seats, check underneath the passenger seat. I open up the trunk. They're hot on a trunk. Now, mind you, I used to roll with a small arsenal of blades. Hmm. And there's not one. There isn't even a penknife in the car. They even took my switch out of the freaking glove compartment. Like, they went through the whole car.
Right.
They must have had a shopping bag full of weapons that they took out of this car. I mean, I had a 12-inch Bowie knife. I had a Rambo blade. I mean, literally anything in that could have dispatched me rather quickly. So, being the good improviser that I am, I searched around and it's the area that I went is frequented by drinkers. So I knew some form of glass somewhere. I wouldn't have to look very far to find it. So I found a Bud Ice bottle and I smashed it and I took good size shard of glass. And I went out, and in the area there was, it's not there anymore, but there was a big boulder by the side of the road off the way. So if you were to drive by, you wouldn't readily notice that I was there. Mm-hmm. You'd see the car and you just figure somebody went for a hike, which people do sometimes up there. I thought it out. I was like, I know this area too well. I grew up here. This is my stomping ground. The least I can do is bleed out on my stomping ground. So I break the bottle. I have the shard. I sit on the rock and I proceed to cut my wrist. And I don't do it the wrong way. I'm not going across my wrist. Right, I'm going along the vein because that's how it works. They're not going to be able to fix you up quick. By that point, you'll be sanguinated and there's nothing.
Right.
So I'm cutting and I can see the meat separating as I'm cutting. And I'm just not bleeding. There's just no blood coming out of me. I'm like, okay, maybe I'm really dehydrated. So, you know, I'm going to cut a little more. So I keep cutting and I get the slightest of a trickle, like a tiny little drip. And then June of 95 was a very, very dry summer. There hadn't been rain. There's no moving water near where I was. But I smell what smells like fresh rain, lilac, and lavender. And I hear a voice tell me, and it's a voice that was at one point a voice I had never heard before in my life to that point. And at the same time, it was a voice that was so familiar to me that at that moment, I felt like I was home. And it said, get up, clean yourself off, and go and get help. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to argue with this because I don't know where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And these odors should not be around at this point. So I have visual cues, I have auditory cues, and I have olfactory clues that are going off.
Right.
So I get in my car and I drive to my dealer's house, who I had been living with on and off, cheating on my fiance with. Mm. And the minute I got to her, I started bleeding. Mm. And she wrapped me up. She put gauze and wrapped me up tight and brought me to my parents' house. And from there, I was whisked away to Yale to get taken care of. And that's where my recovery started. But it was such a strange experience. I'd had other experiences, again, similar to that, but not the same as that. Like each experience that I've had is, like I said, it doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Okay, fair enough.
So, I mean, this was the last in a, I don't want to say a long line of suicide attempts, because I had tried to kill myself before in the past a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But this was like that was it. There was no coming back from this one.
And that's what got you clean, obviously.
Yeah, I didn't have a choice. I mean, how do you argue with that?
Yeah, the universe is trying to tell you something.
I mean, literally. At that point, I was drinking a case of beer a night, a bottle of Yukon, and I was smoking and eating anything I could get my hands on.
Hmm. Except McDonald's.
Except McDonald's. Screw McDonald's. I was a big Taco Bell fan back then, though.
Huh. All right. Well, yeah, I think that's a good place to stop.
I'm sure people stopped listening a long time ago.
I wouldn't think so. That was a fairly unique and interesting story. And people can find you on Project Archivist regularly.
Yeah, we record once a week, or so, try to.
Right. And you do your own solo thing here and there.
I do. That's the spark. I've stalled a little bit. I do have people that I have on the dock that are going to talk that I'm going to have on to speak, mm-hmm. but I'm just trying to figure out how that's going to happen with my schedule. Competition season starting up again. For the girls for dance, everybody but my youngest is in Girl Scouts, which we're trying to find a troop for her. So I'm not home more than I am home.
Right.
So.
All right. Well, what's the website for Project Archivist?
We're on Podbean, www.projectarchivist.com. We're on Twitter, Facebook. We have a Facebook. I'm not currently on Facebook at the moment. But we have a Facebook page. Come over there. You know, ask to be added to the page. You're going to have to answer some questions because we don't want bots anymore. They're pretty easy. You know,
really?
Yeah, the questions are pretty easy. We get some really off the wall answers, but at least we know they're being answered. You know, like what's the main ingredient in tomato soup?
Hmm.
I mean, most bots don't know what that is.
They just got to get smarter. That's all.
Well, you know,
won't take them long.
Probably not.
They'll be able to Google things eventually.
Oh, they're great. Just what we need. Artificial intelligence that's misinformed. Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you for spending some time with us, Lobo.
Thank you for having me on, Soraya.
All right. Remember to check him out on Project Archivist. It's a good show. Now, we're going to take you out with some Genitor. I actually checked them out last night. I haven't seen them in a while. Went to see them in a sort of a Halloween sort of themed show. It's just them and Sinjuro Fields, who I've also played here before. They're from Cortland, New York. This is a song called Cause a Scene. See you next time.